Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Adult Education at Nassau Church. I'm Holly Barreto, and I have the honor of introducing my husband, Eric, as our speaker for the next 6 weeks. Eric is the Weyerhaeuser Associate Professor of New Testament at Princeton Theological Seminary. Eric's work mostly focuses on the book of Luke and Acts and race in the New Testament. Eric is an excellent smoker of meats, and he really enjoys watching TV. You can ask him what his favorite shows are later. Eric will be with us throughout the season of Lent, speaking on reading Luke backwards, which I personally am very interested to hear how this is going to go. So please join me in welcoming Eric Barreto.
Good morning, friends. This is Agnes. Awesome. Delightful. Glad to be here. We tried to do this 2 years ago, and I don't remember, but it got interrupted. Slight. So if we do this for 2 weeks and things go awry, we're never doing this again. So I'll try again. Delighted to be with you all. They can see the S there. Okay, good. Delighted to be with you. I am excited to spend the next couple of weeks looking at the Gospel of Luke in coordination with Dave and his preaching. So we're going to try to read Luke backwards, and there's a couple reasons that we're going to try to do that, which we'll talk about in a second. Partly it's that this has been a disruptive season for a lot of us. There's, of course, the pandemic, our politics. The world is in a difficult moment as well. And so reading this text backwards might be the kind of disruption, the kind of positive disruption that we need. Not only that, I think part of what we're facing is that there are many stories that we might tell about the cross of Jesus in this season. And I think Luke tells a particular story, a story about the cross that I think might be helpful to us. In this season, we might be poised to turn to this Lenten season, to Good Friday and Easter Sunday, as we prepare these weeks with a new set of questions and maybe in need of a renewed perspective. So what if we read this text backwards, starting with the cross and ending in a few weeks in the arms of Mary? Partly because Luke did not intend for his gospel to be read only once, or to be read for the first time by the people who picked up that text. We'll talk about this more in a second, but the expectation is that you already know the story when you dig into Luke chapter 1. But I think there's other reasons for it. One is starting at the end might just disorient us in the best way possible. A story that we've heard over and over again, some of us, for many, many years, right? The Lenten season, the season that comes over and over, it might disorient us to start in on Good Friday as we begin Lent, and end with stories that we usually associate with Christmas. And second, then, that mixes the liturgical season some as well. Again, mixing up the stories that we expect to hear. I think third, what it might do for us is that it might hear us hear stories in a different light. Oh, somebody else is trying to connect to this. We'll go find Annalise somewhere. All right. Allow us to hear stories in a different light. But most importantly, because in one sense, I think this might be how Luke wanted us to read, or at least how the text sets us up to understand Jesus anew. If the story in the Gospel of Luke is meant for people who've heard the story before, people who know the story, people who've heard the story over and over again, but need to hear the story in a new light, need to have the story disrupted, then we might just be poised to read Luke backwards. But why do we start with the cross at the beginning here of Lent? The crosses we wear around our necks and adorn our church steeples are usually no longer symbols of trauma. Instead, they are, or they should be, symbols of welcome, symbols of inclusion, symbols of redemption, symbols of forgiveness, symbols of love and of grace. And you might remember this picture. This was the picture right after the Notre Dame Cathedral caught on fire. This was one of the first pictures that emerged. So here we have this powerful picture of destruction, but the glowing cross standing still. Here, the cross is a defiant symbol, a symbol of persistence, a symbol of hope. These are all really important visions and perspectives to have on the cross. This is all well and good and beautiful and true, but I wonder if we might revisit the cross again and feel its sharp edges. After all, the cross is the strangest of good news. We talk about it being the cross being the defeat of death with death. The death of empire's arrogations as the empire takes yet another innocent life. Eternal life, our eternal life is purchased, but with the death of God's Son. Forgiveness is shared at the cross, but at a place apparently devoid of mercy. So the cross is really strange good news. I think for the gospel writers, the cross is also a lens that clarifies and sharpens our vision. The disciples struggle to understand who Jesus is. His parables, his teachings are always kind of lagging behind. But the cross is clarifying. The cross brings into sharp relief the significance of a story about seeds strewn on the ground, the restoration of the widow's son, the tears Jesus shed in a lonely garden. And the gospel writers, I think, are asking us to read forwards and then read backwards. We move from sentence to sentence, but then we come back to them when we read them again with a new awareness once we know where the story is going. And I wonder if for us too, the cross can be that kind of clarifying lens. The tricky part, I think, is that the cross is not singular. There's not one story to tell about the cross. The cross does not mean just one thing. The fact that we have these four distinct accounts of the death of Jesus is at least one clear indication that no one story can capture the weight and the meaning of the cross. There's not one story that's enough. We need many stories of the cross. And I think often, at least for me, I know I need help to see how the cross remains meaningful today. And so during this season, we'll turn to Luke's stories and discover that his account of the cross is distinctive and I think provides an important perspective for us. And let Luke's account brings with it a clarity about our current crises, our complicities and injustice, but also something about the source of our hope and the power of God's grace. So that's where we're going to head throughout the season. All right, so I said we're going to read Luke backwards, but let's start at the beginning. So this is Luke's first four verses. So anytime I read the Gospel of Luke, and if you've heard me teach from the Gospel of Luke, we've done this exercise before, but we'll do it again because there's new people. In my classes at the seminary, we'll take a whole like hour and a half and just mess with the Greek text for a while. So we'll do it briefer today, but I think importantly nonetheless. So Luke starts like this. Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I got to take a deep breath, decided after investigating everything carefully from the very first to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. Okay. It's a great Greek sentence, terrible English sentence, right? It just goes on and on and on. My high school English teachers would not have allowed me to write something like this. But I think one of the things that Luke does from the very first is to give us a sense of why he's writing, what he thinks he's seeking to accomplish with this text. So I want to highlight three things that I think Luke tells us in these first four verses. Number one is notice that Luke acknowledges that other people are writing stories about Jesus too. So he says, since many have undertaken. Others have tried to do this, and I think Luke appreciates their stories to a certain level. So scholars generally agree that Mark was probably written first. Luke and Matthew are using Mark independently of each other. So Luke is like cribbing off of Mark in some spaces. There's this great meme, I should have put it up, where you have two kids in a classroom and one of them is Luke and one of them is Mark and Luke is looking over Mark's shoulder, right, off of his test paper. So at the very least, Luke appreciates Mark enough to draw upon Mark, to use Mark's words, to draw upon Mark's chronology often. And yet there's also something else that Luke wants to do. He appreciates Mark, draws upon Mark, but says, there's other things I want to tell my people about the story of Jesus. Many have undertaken to do this, and I'm going to do this too because there are more stories to tell about Jesus. Apparently for Luke, one story wasn't enough. So that's the first thing to notice is that others wrote stories about Jesus, and Luke wants to write one too. Second is when he says here that he wants to write an orderly account for you. And we might think that this means that Luke doesn't love the chronological order or the geographical order, that Luke is like a real historian, he's going to get the details right. But I think Luke is after something else in writing this. What does he mean by orderly? I think what he means by orderly has more to do with literature and theology than anything else. It's not about getting the order right and the, you know, like the cause and effect. I think he's interested in telling stories in a particular way. So one of the things you might notice as you read the Gospel of Luke is that Luke tends to pair stories about a man with a story about a woman, right? So he'll talk about the centurion who has a servant who needs to be healed, and right after it is the story of the widow of Nain. I don't think that Luke is putting those two stories together because they happened in chronological order like that. But because in reading the story about a woman next to a story about a man, those two stories mutually inform one another. Or think about Luke chapter 15. So it's I tell my students that if Luke had only one chapter to write instead of 24, he would write Luke 15. So this is the story about the prodigal, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the prodigal son all grouped together. I wonder if Luke's audience already knew those stories. They'd heard the story about the lost coin. They'd heard the story about the lost sheep. They'd heard the story of the prodigal son. But maybe they hadn't heard those stories together. And in telling those stories together in that order, something new about those stories came up for those folks. So Luke is interested in writing what he calls an orderly account, which I think has a lot to do with how he writes the story and the kind of perspective on God that he's going to bring to that text. And last, Luke tells us why he's writing, which none of the other gospel writers really tell us. I think we can figure out usually what they think they're after. But here Luke tells us, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. This is how we know that Luke's first readers don't need spoiler alerts. Right? When Jesus starts talking about the cross or the persecutions that are coming, he doesn't need to say spoiler alert. They're not gasping when Jesus comes out of the grave. They already know the story. They've woven their life around that story. But what's happened? It may be that this community knows the story of Jesus, has embraced it, has loved it, but is also facing a time of trial or a time where the community is maybe falling apart or there's conflict. We don't know exactly what it is, but there's something that's happening in this community that the truth that they once knew, maybe people are wondering about or looking for some other way to think about a truth that they once believed, but now maybe are wondering what's next. What is God doing in our community? So we know, right, that Luke is writing for people who already know the story. And what he wants for them is to know this truth. And I don't think the truth that Luke means here is a set of kind of propositional truths, a checklist of things that we believe. The fundamental truth that I think Luke is after is a truth about the character of God, the character of God's activity. How does God move in and amongst us? How does God shape our world? Those three things are the ones that I think I want to emphasize as we begin. Others wrote stories about Jesus. Luke knows this. He's interested in writing this orderly account that we're going to mess up a little bit by reading it backwards. And he's writing so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. Anything else you notice in this prologue that you're wondering about, that you have questions about, please.
I never associated servants of the word with Luke. I associate the word with John.
Servants of the word, often associate it with the Gospel of John. So I think part of what's happening here is that he's telling us that he wasn't there. He's telling us that he wasn't an eyewitness, but that he talked to the eyewitnesses, and then also these servants of the word. Who are they? Most likely in this context, it seems to be people who heard the story from eyewitnesses and are therefore reliable. They're servants of the word because they've preserved those stories, they're carrying on those stories, they share those stories. So I think that's what that text means there. Yeah, good. Good question, please.
The phrase orderly account, yep, is there twice. Is it different in the Greek or is it the same?
I think it's the same if I remember right. Yeah, so at the beginning there, since many have undertaken, many have tried to do this, now I'm going to write my own orderly account for you. If you read the Gospel of Mark, right, I'm teaching Intro New Testament right now, and one of the things I want my students to remember is that if you see the word immediately, it's probably from the Gospel of Mark. Mark just says immediately all the time that Jesus is doing something for two verses, and immediately he goes and does something else. There's this like rush in the Gospel of Mark, a rush to the cross. And I'm wondering if he sees that as some kind of order, but that he's interested in a different kind of order in Luke's own account. Jesus isn't quite in the same rush in Luke that he is in Mark, for example. Good. Anybody else? Please.
Do you see that he's addressing some of the writings that aren't in our four Gospels as well in terms of addressing this others have attempted, but here's Mark's early account?
Right. So is he addressing accounts that we don't have in the New Testament? So not just Mark, but maybe some others that we don't have in there. So certainly, because... And this is getting into the scholarly weeds, but there are sources that Luke seems to be tapping into that aren't Mark, but that we don't have in any other source besides what we have in Luke. So there's the stuff that's only found in the Gospel of Luke, the parable of the prodigal son, the parable of the Good Samaritan. It's only found in Luke. So where did Luke find those? Well, probably a set of sources that were distinctive to Luke. And then there's stuff that's in Matthew and Luke, but not in Mark. Where did that stuff come from? So we know he means all kinds of sources, some of which we don't have, but we can kind of sort of try to reconstruct by putting these texts together.
I'm wondering if it's a criticism
also. Oh, is it a criticism also of those texts? Yeah. So this, scholars debate about this, right? Is it many have undertaken and they stink, and I'm going to write to you the right account, right? So they have tried to write orderly accounts, but they failed. So here I come, I'm going to write my orderly account. I think that's one way, except the problem with that, I think, for it to be only criticism, is that he's at least using Mark. So he can't be, right? Can't be, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or, yeah, so I wonder, there might be, right, he might think there are errors there that he's going to fix. What I see him doing more, though, especially in how Luke is drawing upon Mark, it's less about it's wrong and I need to fix it, but there's something about my people, the people I know best, that they need to hear a story a little bit different than what's being heard in here. Right? I think it's about that proliferation of stories. So it's not Luke trying to crowd out the other stories, but adding his own voice to these stories.
Also, Mark writing for Jews and Luke writing for...
Good question. Yeah, is there a note here about Mark writing for one community, say Jews, and Luke writing for Gentiles? There's a lot of scholarly argument about this. Luke, for a long time, has been assumed to be a Gentile writing for Gentiles, and now people are messing that up all the time, right? So because it's so hard to figure out who these authors are, the names get attached quite a bit later. It's a really tricky enterprise to figure out the authors of these. So, this is all, even this, telling us so much, leave so much left unsaid as well. Good, please, yeah.
How much does the background and the personality of the writers influence what they did?
How much does the background of the authors influence what they did? I would imagine, and their personality? I would imagine immensely so, right? I mean, think about some of your favorite authors. Let's say they write something new, and you pick it up and it doesn't say who their name is, you might be able to figure out from your favorite authors who they are, right? This sounds like so-and-so. And I imagine that's the case here. We do have Luke, we have Acts, so we've got at least a big sample size of Luke's account. But again, there's so little we can know about Luke that we can pick up some pieces of his personality and some of the things he cares about, perhaps. But still tricky work to do. Good. Marvelous. Okay, last one, please. So might Luke have been responding to Gnostics or other groups of the time? It's hard to say just because, again, he tells us so very little about that. I mean, this tells us a lot, but also doesn't fill in so many of these gaps. Presumably, there is a multitude of stories out there, and some of the stories he likes better than others, or thinks some of the stories are legitimate and others are less so. But he seems to be focusing, instead of critiquing, at least explicitly, other stories, is telling the story that he thinks his community needs most. So good question about that. Awesome. Yes.
Who is Theophilus?
We all know this, right? No. So for a long time, the assumption was that Theophilus might have been a Roman official of some sort, right? So somebody who could influence Christian communities, and that this is a way to Luke to write to this Roman official Theophilus to say, we're not a threat to you, the Roman Empire, so you can leave us alone. But I don't know if y'all read Luke. It's 24 chapters and Acts is 28. It's a lot to read. And to think about the underlying assumptions about who's reading it, somebody who knows the truth about the things you have been instructed. I think this is a text for believers. So who is this Theophilus? It could be a patron of sorts, somebody who paid for Luke's journeys, paid for his upgrades to Comfort Plus on planes. I don't know, right? Something like that, right? But what I love to think about this is that this is two Greek words. Theo means God. And love, someone who loves God. So I like to think that this is written for folks who love God, and that includes us as well. All right, so let's jump into the text from, I'll fix that for next week. All right, we'll do as well as we can. So if this isn't printed quite as well as I would like, so if you want, you can look up, if you have a phone, you can look up Luke 23, starting in verse 32. But this is how the story goes from there. So this is, we're digging in, this is after Jesus has been condemned as he's headed to the cross. So they led him away. As they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming from the country, and they laid the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A great number of the people followed him, and among them were women who were beating their breasts and wailing for him. But Jesus turned to them and said, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For the days are surely coming when they will say, 'Blessed are the barren, and the wombs that never bore, and the breasts that never nursed.' Then they will begin to say to the mountains, 'Fall on us,' and to the hills, 'Cover us.' For if they do this when the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry?" We're starting dark, all right? We're going right into, right. So this is where the disruption of this happens. So we might have started with stories about Jesus and his ministry and his healing, but to start here at this, the very beginning of the narrative of the cross, I think is disruptive to us in a way that's helpful. A couple things I would highlight. Number one is, notice how even at the very beginning of the story, the power of the state is in the foreground. I was struck again by the word, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene. The sense that there is this power that the state has to pick somebody seemingly from random, from the crowd, someone who was just coming in from the country, who had nothing to do with the crimes of the people, that supposed crimes of the people they're about to execute, that these Roman officials can just seize somebody and make them carry this cross for someone who's about to be executed publicly. So even at the beginning of the story, the power of the state is a powerful force. Second, notice how grief is accompanying Jesus on the way to a trauma he's about to experience. A trauma that his disciples are going to experience from afar, and a trauma that maybe as we're reading the story, we will experience too. There's literally a group of people following Jesus already grieving for what's going to happen to him. This group of women who are beating their breasts, we're going to hear this term again, or this phrase again, in a bit in this story. So the power of the state, the shape of grief following Jesus, and last are these strange apocalyptic words, words about the end of the world, about judgment, about the ways that the natural world is going to kind of embody the judgment of God. What do we make of these stories at the end? I think sometimes when we run into these apocalyptic words, our minds go to big fantastical movies like Oh, what's the one with Bruce Willis and the meteor? Y'all remember this story, this movie? There's a meteor coming, it's going to destroy the Earth, so they send Bruce Willis up in a space. Do you know this? No? Armageddon. It's literally entitled Armageddon or Independence Day, where the aliens come, right, and everything's about to fall. Right, so I think that's often where my mind, maybe just me, okay. I go there, and I start thinking about the kind of big, fantastical, universal aliens and, right, the end of the world stuff, right, those kind of end of the world movies. But I wonder if what's happening here is a little bit more ordinary and everyday. That this warning, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children, is already and indicating for us where the story is going. That this isn't some threat for the future, that there's judgment coming, but that the judgment is here and it is now. That these daughters of Jerusalem have children who might be caught in the webs of Rome's imperial violence too. Do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. This violence that's being inflicted on me isn't just inflicted on me. It's inflicted on these two other guys with me too, and maybe your children as well. It's about this everyday reality of what it means to live in the shadow of empire's power. So those three things I would highlight. Anything else that you all notice that you'd like to highlight from in these texts or wonderings or questions you have here? Please, yeah. Might he be discussing the destruction of the temple, which he does earlier, and he does that in the wake, the story of the widow's mite starts Luke chapter 20. She's coming and she's giving from her poverty. The rich are giving from their abundance. And right after that, Jesus starts talking about the destruction of the temple as a judgment upon a place that's supposed to be a place about the flourishing of life, about the power of God, and instead has become a place where the poor are taken advantage of, and the rich get away with not giving very much at all. So that is kind of coursing through these last chapters, this sense of judgment that has this this big sense about empires and temples, but I think here kind of brings it down to the everyday of life, that this judgment isn't going to happen out there. It's in our midst today. Yes. So yeah, this literally happens. So the Emperor Titus will eventually destroy the temple, burn it to the ground, and it happens presumably within the lifetime of the of these narrative characters. Yeah, good. Good observation, please.
My first reaction to this is that I don't think I've ever seen or read that last paragraph that you have, the daughters of Jerusalem. When we hear it read, we hear Simon, Cyrene, and a great number of people following him, and then we stop.
Well, because this is weird, right?
Yeah. And my second reaction is the last sentence, for if they do this when the wood is green, what will happen if it is dry? Because wood is so often what you use to as a metaphor for the cross.
Right.
The wood. The wood often means the cross.
Yeah.
So this wood is pretty green right now.
Yeah.
If he's, Simon's carrying it right behind him, and
yeah,
he's going to be executed on.
So just for the folks listening along, right, that so often, I think often the lectionary cuts us off from the stuff at the end here that's a little bit harder to read, a little harder to imagine what Jesus is doing with these words, but also the connection between the wood. When the wood is green, what will happen when it is dry? And the literal pieces of wood that are going to both, upon which Jesus will be hung, but also that Simon is carrying. Great. All right, so we continue in the story. So this is 39 through 43. The story continues. Two others also who were criminals, and we'll talk about that in a second. That's not a great translation. Were led away to be put to death with Jesus. When they came to the place that is called the Skull, they crucified Jesus there with the criminals, one on his right and one on his left. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." And they cast lots to divide his clothing. And the people stood by watching. But the leader scoffed at him, saying, "He saved others. Let him save himself if he is the Messiah of God, his chosen one." The soldiers also mocked him, coming up and offering him sour wine and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There is also an inscription over him: "This is the King of the Jews." So a couple things I would observe here. One is that this word criminals that you see a couple times, I almost wish we could translate that more like terrorists. Because that's, I think, the perspective that Rome has on these folks. These are not just people who are stealing things or, you know, just causing public disruption, but folks who are threats to the order of the day. Right? They are terrorists. There are people who are trying to overthrow Roman rule, or people that in some way are so disrupting the peace that they are a threat to the order of the day. And that Jesus is counted among them as someone who poses a threat to the Roman Empire. There's all this stuff about being the King of the Jews. The mockery is you're not a king. You thought you were a king. If you were a king, you could stop this. If you were a king, you would save yourself, because we know what kings look like. Kings do not end up strung up on crosses. Kings are in throne rooms. Kings kill other people. You're no king. Second notice is Luke here is not very subtle. The place that is called the skull, right? So this is part of the tradition. We see this in both Mark and in Matthew as well. But just a reminder that this is a place of death, a place where presumably others have also faced their death, and where others after Jesus will do it as well. This isn't the first or the last time that people have come to this place called the skull. You'll notice to this verse here, then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing," has this bracket. What that means is that there's some uncertainty about whether or not this was something that Luke would have written himself. Some manuscripts don't have that particular verse. So then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing." So there's...
the one we all know.
Yeah.
What's the question, the second part or the whole thing?
Just from here to here. Then Jesus said, "Father, forgive them." There's a bracket over here and behind the bezel, I promise. So there's uncertainty about this. So what is the place of forgiveness in this narrative? One, that this is the story that we know, right? And if you've been to a Seven Words event, this is, but there's textual uncertainty about this text. What is the place of forgiveness if this verse is missing? Let's think about that. And then this claim to save yourself, this call to save yourself, to use the power that you seem to have, a misunderstanding, I think, of the kind of power that Jesus is about to show us here in a second. All right, let's get to a couple more slides, just because I'm looking at time and I'll make sure we have time for questions at the end. So the story continues that one of the criminals who were hanged there kept deriding him and saying, "Are you not the Messiah? Save yourself." And us. But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed have been condemned justly, for we are getting what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And he replied, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." You'll notice that one of the terrorists joins in. "Save yourself, Jesus." The soldiers do this, the crowds do this, and then one of the terrorists who's hanging there is also joining in. Also the addition of "and us." While you're at it, save yourself, and don't forget about us. So there's that. One of the terrorists joins in, but the other is, notice that what the other says, and especially here, "We indeed have been condemned justly." There's a scholar named Shelley Matthews whose reading of this text has messed with my head. She notices that no commentator that she can find questions what that second terrorist says. "We indeed have been condemned justly." Well, but what could somebody do where this kind of cruel, public, agonizing execution would be a just punishment? Is he right that he's been condemned justly? And have we just not noticed that maybe in the midst of this moment of death, he misses and we miss the reality that no one deserves something like this? And last is this word today, a word that for Luke is very important. The first public words that Jesus utters are in Luke chapter 4. He goes back to home to his synagogue in Nazareth and preaches there. And he says, today, these words have been fulfilled in your hearing. And if you remember from back 2 years ago, we talked about the shape of salvation and the todayness of the salvation that Luke is articulating. That todayness is not a throwaway word for Luke. It's a continuation of this theme throughout, that salvation is not something that's deferred, not something for later. Salvation is for today. Last. Yes, sure. Oh, I am not a physicist, so I don't know if I can be helpful here. Hopefully somebody in the room is a physicist. Yeah.
This criminal in paradise, and yet today he's also going to spend 3 days in hell
in the ground, yeah.
For the resurrection.
Yeah.
There's a duality of
this. Yeah. And so much of the New Testament seems to imagine that people, we see this in the letters of Paul, for example, the imagination is that we don't like float off into heaven, we're in the ground waiting for the resurrection. But here we get a sense of the immediacy of that salvation. I think the New Testament is often wrestling with the realities of resurrection, about paradise, about heaven, and where Jesus is to be found. So we'll have Jesus ascended at the end of the Gospel of Luke, as well as the beginning of the book of Acts. But Jesus, throughout the book of Acts, is still doing stuff. He's still healing people in his name. He's still present, for example, when he encounters Saul on the road to Damascus. So the question about the presence of Jesus is really striking. And I think Jesus is fine breaking the laws of physics. I think he feels unconstrained by them.
I also want to point out that if there's another place for forgiveness, here
yeah. It is. Yeah, if there's another place for forgiveness, right? So even without that text, there is the sense, you will be with me. The forgiveness is still available in this moment. Good observation. All right, so the story concludes in this way for us today, at least. It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 p.m, while the sun's light failed, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two. Then Jesus, crying with a loud voice, said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." Having said this, he breathed his last. When the centurion saw what had taken place, he praised God and said, "Certainly this man was innocent." When all the crowds who had gathered there for this spectacle saw what had taken place, they returned home beating their breasts. But all his acquaintances, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. So I want us to notice three reactions that people have to the cross. One is that Jesus is innocent. It's a refrain throughout these last chapters of the Gospel of Luke that Jesus is innocent. It's confirmed by Pilate. It's confirmed by Herod. All along is the sense for Luke that Jesus did not deserve this. He did nothing to earn this. But still, the question remains for us. Here is a centurion who presumably who's done this before and will do this again. What does he see in Jesus that makes him pause and say, certainly this man was innocent? What was it about the way that Jesus died? Is Jesus really special? And the centurion sees in Jesus something really special. And I wonder if what the centurion sees is not that Jesus is special, but that Jesus is quite ordinary. That he's neither the first nor the last innocent person to be hung up on a Roman cross. That there's something about the system that is profoundly broken, profoundly unjust. And the way that Jesus dies, the brokenness of the system, how it takes the innocent and executes them, becomes evident even to the centurion who is tasked with doing this work. So that's number one, is that Jesus is innocent. Second, and I find this so haunting, is that when all the crowds who had gathered there for this spectacle, this word spectacle stands out to me, that these people came out to see a show. They came out to be delighted. They came out to be entertained by this spectacle. And my first reaction is to be quite judgmental about these folks. Like, why would you go out to do this? Why would you go and watch this public execution for fun? Why would you do this? And yet I hesitate to judge, because we know that public executions were a thing for a long time in history. We know that people would go to lynchings in their Sunday best and take pictures and collect souvenirs. And maybe it's not exactly the same thing, but we know what it's like to slow down on the road when there's some terrible accident, to see what's there. For those of us that like to watch football, the spectacle of people hurting each other for a living and for our delight. This draw to spectacle is a human draw. They came out to see a spectacle. They came out to see how Roman violence upon somebody else, how we seem to assume that if that violence is directed at someone else, that it won't come toward us. It won't affect us. The sense that violence can keep us safe. They came out to see a spectacle. And the third reaction is that they returned home beating their breasts. So they came out to see a spectacle, but what they saw was something that they shouldn't have seen. They go away grieving over what they've seen, because what did they see? They saw an innocent person die. They saw a person who shouldn't have died this way do so publicly and gruesomely.
Is there room in your interpretation for the idea that some of those people were waiting for him to save themselves? Some of those people had been on the road on Sunday.
Was there some expectation that he might actually Messiah in that moment? Messiah. So we have the women who are walking along with Jesus grieving, but they all came out to see a spectacle. They all came out to, they're all jeering at him, at least in Luke's narration, right? They're all mocking him. So it's not save yourself, we know you can. It's save yourself, we know you can't. We know where power actually resides. It's in Caesar's hands, not in yours. And then what we do have is his acquaintances, including these women who had followed him from Galilee that Luke talks about in Luke chapter 8, who provide for the disciples. They're standing at a distance. So there's a separation between the crowd that came out to see a spectacle and at least some of his followers watching from a distance, seeing what's happened. So they return home beating their breasts. And I wonder if this is the reaction that Luke wants us to have to in reading this account. That when we get to the cross, we don't just revel over what's happened and celebrate, but we mourn what we've seen. We mourn that an innocent Jesus died at the hands of an empire trying to seek supposed peace. So for Luke, the cross is not a moment of celebration and acclamation. The cross is a blunt instrument of tragedy. The cross is a moment of deep trauma. The cross shows us our own, the depths of our own inhumanity. The cross is cruelty and death and violence all wrapped up into one. So think for a moment about the stories you have heard, the stories you have told, the stories you have loved and held on to with all your might about the cross. And let me remind you that I imagine that the stories you're thinking about right now are needed stories, they're powerful stories, they're transformative stories, they're good stories. This isn't about Luke's account crowding out all the others. But think for a minute, but also think throughout the day, what did you hear in Luke's account of the cross that enlightens or maybe even disrupts those stories about Jesus and the cross that you have heard, that you have told, that you have loved, that you've held on to? My hope is that Luke's account of the cross is that kind of lens that helps us see the cross in places that we maybe wouldn't have seen it before. So this is a picture from the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. It's a memorial to folks who were victims of lynchings throughout the country. And those stones, I think, are meant to represent the weight of those deaths looming over all of us. I wonder if Luke helps us see that the cross of Jesus is not all that special in one sense, that the cross of Jesus is not all that rare, that the cross is all around us still, haunting us even as we seek after it like a spectacle. This picture was from November 17, 2018. Migrants being tear gassed at the U.S.-Mexico border. The sense among us that if we can keep others out, maybe the benefits of empires will be ours alone. If we keep out these folks, maybe there will be peace. This is from summer of 2020. What Luke's account does for me is that when I read the account, I think about George Floyd calling for his mother. I think about the weight of the state and the violence that is meant to make some of us feel safe by making others afraid. I think about all that weight on his neck. And I can't imagine but think about Jesus too. So that's the invitation for this season, is to read Luke backwards, starting with the cross of Jesus and seeing how that account of the cross, that traumatic, terrible moment, enlightens for us all these other stories in this Lenten season as we head towards Easter. I meant to finish a little earlier, but I have to stop now. We will see you all next week. Thank you for being here. Happy to hang out for a little while too if people have questions. Thank you.